And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
How are ya?
How is your day going?
I hope it's going great.
Are you listening on drop day? Is it Tuesday?
Is it another day?
Is it a day that ends in Y?
You
motherfucker.
You guys, if you are listening and you're not driving, don't do this. If you're driving, do it after. But why don't you give us like a little follow, a little rate, a little review, a little comment? I saw recently on our analytics, because I am the numbers girly, that only a third of you are following us.
What?
And we love you all so much, but we want you here at the table. And the way we get extra security for that is with everybody giving us like a little follow or a little download or something.
Yeah. Tells us that you guys want us to keep doing this. Otherwise, we're going to keep having these conversations, but like, we don't know if you want to hear them.
Right. I want to know that you know that we know that you want them.
I want to know that you know that we know. Most importantly, that you know that we know.
But they don't know we know they know we know they know we know.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
You guys get it. I know that about you. And I've always said that. But really, seriously, we would love it if you just let us know that you like what you're hearing.
Yeah.
Maybe poor timing in our request of this, because today's episode is, how you say, horrible.
Horrible, heinous, bad, awful, no good.
You were wondering what the big surprise was. This is what it is. We're giving you a serial killer. Yay.
Boo.
This sucked. We cried a lot.
A lot.
But the other cool thing about this series is that we're kind of doing it Karen Reed style. And by that, I mean, is that we worked on the research together. So neither of us is going to be, unfortunately, surprised. We're going to just be sitting in the sorrow together.
Yeah. And hopefully with you too. Obviously, we know that you know because you clicked on it, but it is Dean Corll. But part of the inspiration for this was there was a new documentary. Well, kind of a documentary. It was like a interview that happened with an accomplice of Dean Corll, who we're talking about today. And this was an interview with Elmer Wayne Henley. And the documentary is called The Serial Killer's Apprentice. So it's really good. We watched it. It's going to be incorporated. We'll talk about it later. But we figured while there's sort of some things circling, I've seen quite a few people do one-parters, two-parters on this. But we, we're overachievers here. And we wanted to give you a lot of information because that's kind of our thing.
We are type A, A-plus students who
don't
know when to stop.
And so we don't know when we'll stop. But we definitely have at least three, if not four, parts of this coming your way. And it's a lot. And we'll get into it pretty quick. But before we hop all the way into it, I do just want to see if there's anything that you guys are into right now that you want to talk about. How's your mom? How's your dad?
What's going on?
You know, how's the pod pet fam? How's it going?
Yeah, and how familiar with this case are you? Because a lot of the really avid true crime listeners are aware of this, but I'll be honest, I feel like people haven't really covered it as of late. I've seen a couple episodes pop up here and there given the interview that was just released, but I haven't really seen a ton of like really solid deep dives.
Yeah. Well, and for someone who has such a large victim count, for the name Dean Corll to not be as sort of infamous as like a Ted Bundy or a Gacy is kind of astounding to me.
Well, that, and we will talk in a later part about a possible connection between Dean Corll and John Wayne Gacy. So
yeah,
when we talk about these prolific killers, I think he kind of hit at a time where there were so many. In the 70s and 80s, I think there were so many, and some got picked up more than others. I think what is unique about him is something else that we'll talk about, that we don't have any information from him afterwards. We're going to talk about all of that and more, so you better stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We're super excited, and by excited, I mean dreading, and also oddly kind of excited to talk about it. I mean, we have been working on this for God knows how many weeks, and we finally get to share it, which is the blessing and the curse of all of this.
You know, and we try to assess, okay, what could be done differently?
Right.
How could we stop this from happening again? The circumstances are different today, but there are still people preying on kids. And if you didn't know that this is a case about kids, it is. So proceed with caution.
A lot.
Listen with care. But I think you have a thing to say.
So, yoo-hoo, pod's on. Hi, hello, and welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Oh, you guys.
Oh, that's us. You didn't have to, and yet you did. Through me. Yeah,
thank you.
I did for you. You're welcome.
Thanks, Apples.
But as per the usual, we are just going to go through our sources and some trigger warnings up at the top. For sources, you know they are always linked below, and you best believe it's going to be linked in a Google Doc today because holy shit, too many for the little character count we got down there. But we use several articles from the New York Times, Texas Monthly, and the Houston Chronicle. We also utilize the Crime Library and a great book by Jack Olson called The Man with the Candy for many firsthand accounts. And also a big shout out to the Casual Criminalists coverage of this case, which had just like really good research, but was a really good take of, I think, most of the information I've seen compiled, which is awesome. For trigger warnings, just to kind of assume everything, this case is horrendous. It's a pretty horrendous series. And we go into sodomy, rape, and torture of minors, boys from school age to teenagers, and we touch on substance use, high crime areas, and a serial killer who has a literally gigantic victim count. So please, please proceed with immense caution. We get into it right quick. And by right quick, I mean right now. So on August 7th, 1973, in Pasadena, Texas, Elmer Wayne Henley was having a day much like many of the others he had had recently. At that point, his inner circle consisted of David Brooks, a local 18-year-old, and Dean Coral, a 33-year-old. Dean, a serial killer and rapist, had groomed and lured Brooks and Henley, as they're often referred to, in order to help him with these crimes. Often, the two helped lure victims to come to Dean's house, but both of them aided in different parts of the torture, murder, or aftermath at different points in the years that they had come to know and work for Dean. But on this day, or evening, more specifically, Henley invited over 20-year-old Timothy Curley to party at Dean's house. This was a common ruse they would use to lure victims for Dean, just kind of in general. I mean, they'd use a bunch, but this was definitely one of them.
Unfortunately, because what teenager doesn't want to go
party,
have fun at a party where there's a cool older guy that's going to supply shit for you? Hell yeah.
And it's the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I want to smoke weed. Yes, I do. And I'm going to get it for free from this guy that you know? Sick. I'm
and in. You're my friend and we all know each other and we went to school together. I trust you. Let's go.
Yes. So Curley accepted, but on the way to the house, they found a friend, 15-year-old Rhonda Williams, hurt from being beaten by her drunk father. They invited her to come along and she agreed. She was trying to get the hell out of Dodge anyway.
Of course.
And well, to get out and to go party sounded like a way better night than the one she was having. So ready to party, the three arrived at Dean's house where they were offered weed and beer. Dean was seemingly very angry at Henley for bringing a girl to the home, which was neither his victim type nor who he was interested in, as we'll see. But he seemed to calm down after hearing what happened to her that night, where he was like, okay, so she's injured. Her dad is literally the fucking worst and she just needs an escape.
The irony that Dean could have a shred of empathy is not lost on me.
And the empathy seemingly only went so far.
Yeah, about that far.
Yes. He seemed to calm down, but as the three partied, time went on. It gets to about 3 a.m. the next day on August 8th, 1973. Henley and Curley were offered paint fumes to huff, which they very happily partook in. And about 2 hours later, all three of the teens had passed out. But waking up in the morning for the first time, Henley found himself cuffed on the floor. His ankles tied together with tape over his mouth, and the same for Rhonda and Timothy. This was a position that Henley had never been in before. Dean reiterated how furious he was that Henley brought Rhonda over, and he said he planned to kill them all after sodomizing and raping Timothy, who was the only one of the three that was at that point naked. Rhonda, who was still passed out from the drugs, was repeatedly kicked in the chest by Dean, who yelled at her to wake up, bitch, and calling her names. Over the sounds of a loud radio to drown out the noise, Coral wasn't ready to kill Henley without at least a confrontation. After all, they had been accomplices for so long. And I'm pretty sure this was like a major disappointment for Dean, which is crazy to say. But with a gun to Henley's stomach, they talked. And somehow, Henley convinced Dean that if he was going to untie him, that Henley would then help with the torture and the murders. And after some time of going back and forth, I think like a literal half an hour, which is a long time if you think about it. It's a long time
to plead for your life.
Finally, Coral relented before moving Rhonda and Timothy to his torture board. A literal torture board. Dean had a plan. He would torture and rape Timothy, and he told Henley that he expected him to do the same to Rhonda. And now, despite Henley panicking and continuing to huff some paint fumes to, like, kind of distance himself from what was going on, Dean got impatient and was basically like, hurry the fuck up. Like, he was like, what's holding you up? Dean gave Henley an 18-inch knife to remove Rhonda's clothing before he put his pistol aside to undress himself for the beginning of his rape and torture of Timothy. But it was then, in the very early morning of August 8th, 1973, that Henley, just 17 years old, had enough. After attempting to distract Dean with a question, Henley picked up the gun and pointed it at Dean, yelling, "You've gone far enough, Dean. I can't go any longer. I can't have you kill all my friends." Dean, naked and seemingly deranged, started approaching Henley, taunting the boy to kill him. Stumbling back, Henley's last straw was Dean continuing to advance, yelling that he couldn't do it. And Henley shot Dean in the head with a .22 caliber. But the bullet failed to penetrate the skull, leaving Dean alive. And as he continued to approach, Henley shot him a few more times in the shoulder, with one of the bullets puncturing Dean's lung and lodging in his spine. Dean finally relented and began to run away before tripping on a telephone wire and hitting the wall, allowing Henley to shoot him three more times in the back. Dean died naked in the hallway from loss of blood and injuries. Henley's only thought at the time was that how he reacted would have made Dean proud.
So twisted.
Shortly after, still before 9 a.m., Timothy convinced Henley to call the police after untying them. And that was the day that Henley was apprehended by law enforcement. It wasn't until later, as Henley led them to a boat shed to exhume the bodies of Dean's victims, that the world would know Henley's part. As the media surrounded him, filming the search and counting the ever-growing number of bodies that were taken out of this shed, Henley was able to use a car phone to call home. There, the news captured it all as he dialed and waited for a pickup before speaking into the phone. "Mama," he said, "I killed Dean."
Before we jump into Dean Coral's life, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out a significant flaw in the telling of his life. Dean Coral is one of those serial killers that we don't hear from after the fact, as, you know, spoiler alert. He was killed during the commission of his final crime.
Yes.
Because of this, we don't hear in his words what happened, how many victims there truly were, when he began, who he took, or why he did it. There's no interrogation footage, no written statement, interview after the fact, or testimony. This sets him apart from major players like Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer. Further, we don't know if there was an outer network much larger than Dean that he was associated with. Many seem to believe he was part of something much bigger than himself, perhaps a national child sex trafficking ring. Killers who speak out after the fact aren't always the most reliable historians either. So I'm not saying that even if Dean were alive that we would know everything, but sometimes they can fill in the blanks and, more importantly, offer closure to families by leading them to their loved ones' remains.
Yeah.
Especially in this case, we really don't know his true victim count. We don't know how many were labeled as something other than murdered, that he could have maybe offered some kind of closure and peace to the families by bookending their suffering.
Right.
Or at least bookending it for it to start in a new way. Instead, the information that we have about Dean's life and his crimes are filled in by what little evidence was found and the accounts of the people around him. His mother, Mary, is the closest source we have to hearing about his early life, and yet Mary herself lived in disbelief and denial about his crimes. She denied it even after it was out and proven.
Mm-hmm.
Even after his accomplices were caught and spoken to. And she tells a story of his life that sounds almost like a fairy tale.
Definitely.
And other relatives of Dean's did not make public statements, not his dad, not his siblings, nobody else, and you can't blame them. So what we know is kind of pieced together and forcibly taken with a grain of salt, in my opinion.
Right. Anybody who had close information was either very limited in the time that they knew Dean or very limited by bias and maybe denial.
Dean Arnold Coral was born December 24th, 1939, to parents Mary Robinson and Arnold Coral in Fort Wayne, Indiana. His parents had another son, Stanley, a few years after Dean. Mary speaks of her son's childhood as a good one, that their dad was strict and would put them in timeout a lot, and she might often disagree with how long their timeouts lasted and also what they would get put in timeout for, but she did deny any abuse.
Okay.
She said the boys were scared to ask their dad permission to do things. For example, if they wanted to play outside, they asked her and not him. I question this because this would be the 40s and 50s where discipline was usually doled out to the children with a crack of a belt or a wooden spoon or some other kind of physical means.
Yeah.
Maybe it's true. Maybe their dad didn't physically discipline them. But I get the sense in reading many of Mary's accounts that she had a rose-colored glasses view of her children's childhood and essentially maybe the rest of their lives.
Mm.
And we'll get into it, but she was also very busy dating and marrying other men. How often would she really see her son's interactions with their dad?
Right.
Just worth pointing out. But when Dean was 6 years old in 1946, his parents divorced. Divorce in the 40s was rare, and though they fought a lot throughout their marriage, their divorce was seemingly amicable. Mary prioritized her children's relationship with their dad. So after they divorced, when Arnold was drafted into the Air Force and stationed in Tennessee, she sold their Indiana home and relocated to Memphis to be nearby.
Which is pretty...
It's admirable to keep this some semblance of the family unit intact, even though their marriage was no longer.
Right, especially in a time where it's ostracizing to be divorced alone, let alone to probably keep going places where that would follow you. But
absolutely. Mary would describe Dean as a very good boy. He behaved and he listened. He was shy, never really socializing with other children. While her other son was more social, Dean would spend time with others if they were over the house already playing with his brother, but he wasn't really going out of his way to make friends or be present.
Yeah.
This could be in part due to his heart murmur. When he was young, a doctor diagnosed Dean with a heart murmur and said that he needed to be careful with physical activity. He wasn't allowed to participate in sports or his gym class or anything like that. So when other kids would run around and play, Dean had to stay inside. And for that time, especially when a lot of those really core memories were made, the children were like kicked out of the house, like, go play. Like, you cannot get out of the house. Go. Dean wasn't offered that, just physically was not able to do it.
Right. And then any other time he had interaction with other kids, they already had a better friendship with his brother or
just each other because he was never really around.
Right. Or it's during times that it's structured, like they should be in class, they should be learning. They don't really have time to make those friendship bonds.
And it's sad because you kind of picture Dean like waving out a foggy window while they're all playing outside, and you feel bad for the child, absolutely. And physically, yeah, he just wasn't able to do what the other kids were able to do.
And while I want to make it very clear here, I am not jealous of the heart murmur. I absolutely would have loved to not be able to do gym as a kid.
As someone with a heart murmur and who had to do gym, like, yeah, they don't make them like that anymore. Okay. No. They still make you do it. I still had to do the pacer test like everybody else. Ugh,
fuck the pacer test. Anyway.
But back to Dean. In 1950, after his dad was discharged from the Air Force, his parents got back together and remarried.
Mm.
So while divorce was strange at the time, I guess, and kind of looked down upon, remarrying is even stranger.
Yeah.
They then left Tennessee and moved to a suburb of Houston to Pasadena, Texas. But by 1953, his parents' second marriage deteriorated yet again, and they divorced a final time. I imagine this was really strange and confusing for the kids to have your parents on again, off again in a time where divorce was socially unacceptable. That, coupled with the fact that they had moved around a lot, must not have provided much stability for the boys in making long-term friendships.
Yeah.
The parents were split up again and now dating other people, so they didn't really live in one place too long to plant roots.
Right.
After the divorce, the boys saw both parents and spent summers at their maternal grandmother's house in Indiana and helped her tend the farm.
Yeah.
As Dean became of age, where some parents today might give their child an uncomfortable talk about the birds and the bees, or maybe a book on it, Mary did not. Such was the time, I guess. Instead, Mary figured the boys learned everything they needed to know about sex from the farm animals they tended to in Indiana.
Yeah.
And each summer when they went to visit their grandmother and help with the farm, this doubled as sex education. So really, they got a lot of credits.
Well, you know, I will say you can't really keep farm animals from doing that, but it's not really the same as breaking it down to children so that they understand what's happening or why it's important or why you need to be careful.
Exactly. And I would argue that with this approach that Mary took, I think that there's a lot to say that Dean got it all wrong.
Oh, certainly.
Speaking of Mary, she was out on the dating prowl again now that she's a two-time divorcee, if you'd call it that.
Same man, two different divorces.
Two divorces, one man, you know? But I say dating very loosely because she seemed to have, like, met men and married them rather quickly. So for this next relationship, she met him and married him almost immediately. His name was Jake West, and he was a traveling clock salesman.
Mm.
She met him while he was working. Once they were married, they moved to a town called Vidor, Texas, an hour and a half east of Houston. Mary was a great baker, specifically candies and sweets.
Yeah.
And Jake encouraged her to start selling them. So she started with pralines, packaging them up, and Jake would take them on the road with him to try to sell along with the clocks. And it turned out to be pretty lucrative. Now, when Mary and Jake moved to Vidor, Mary's sons were with them.
Yeah.
And Vidor is a place we have to talk about, and really the Houston area at the time as well. But Vidor was severely poverty-stricken. Where many Texan communities struggled, they seemed to especially struggle. In the area that Dean lived in here, and then later in the Houston Heights, the communities were struggling with poverty, and many of the homes were broken. Families were split, too many mouths to feed, kids having more freedom, partially because the parents were just trying to make ends meet.
Right.
And it was also known as a sundown town, meaning that after the sun went down, all of the black people were expected to leave or it would end in violence. So this is the kind of ass backwards, messed up place that we're talking about here. And this is where, you know, these children are growing up. When Dean arrived in 1950, he ended up going to Vidor High School. He was more so a loner, but not really. I didn't see any sources that said he was bullied. I don't know that they would have called it that at the time, the way that right. we might identify it now. But I don't know that he was or that he was considered weird. He just kind of kept to himself. he earned decent grades. He wasn't the worst student in the world, and he was respectful in class. Teachers liked him, thought he was harmless. Due to his heart murmur, still, he couldn't play sports. So he joined the band and played the trombone, which he seemed to enjoy. The only weird thing about him was that he liked to kill flying squirrels, and he'd wear them on a chain around his neck.
Oh, yeah, I don't...
Which I'd argue is, like, really weird.
Yeah.
But maybe at that time, in that place, perhaps it was less weird. I don't think every kid was walking around with that, but I think kids found interest in what they could with what they had.
Yeah, and maybe you're into hunting, but I don't know that you're wearing your game around as a jewelry piece.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Not my style.
Certainly not mine.
His mother dismissed this as him being a boy, and that's what boys do. And again, maybe was the time. But I think it's very strange and upsetting. But maybe in this part of Texas in the mid-50s, it wasn't too bad. I don't know, wasn't there. Now, in this town, his mother and her new husband started a candy company called Pecan Prince, where she made pralines and other sweets. At first, the candy company was run out of their garage, and Dean and his younger brother Stanley were in charge of packaging and running the machinery. This proved to be successful, and in 1958, when Dean graduated high school, the family relocated to Houston to follow the money, as most of the candy sales were from Houston.
Yep.
It's where it was the most successful, so that's where they headed. In 1960, Dean ended up moving to Indiana to help his now widowed grandmother, and then he returned to Houston in 1962, picking up where he left off, running the mother's candy business.
Right.
While he was in Indiana for those couple of years, he began dating a woman. But when she kind of propositioned him for marriage and was kind of asking when he was going to put a ring on it, he yeeted out of there and headed back to Houston without offering an answer. By 1963, his mother Mary had divorced her husband and then started her own company called the Coral Candy Company. Dean was still second in charge under his mother, now appointed the vice president, and he made candy at night while working a day job. He got a job working as an electrician. He actually was like very skilled in that kind of trade work, but I would say his priority was likely working at the candy company.
Yeah.
Also in 1963, a young man working for the company complained to Mary, who was his boss, that Dean was sexually harassing him and not leaving him alone. In all of Mary's wisdom, she decided to fire that kid instead of considering that her own son might be the problem.
That's a trend we see with her, so that tracks.
It's worth stating here that Dean Corll is gay, perhaps bisexual, I don't know, given he did have a relationship with the woman previously, and there's one that we'll talk about later named Becky, but Dean primarily sought out relationships with men.
Yeah.
And at that time, this was not socially acceptable, and he probably would have faced a lot of backlash for this, especially living where he lived, where it was a lot kind of delayed. But I would say his preference did change because it wasn't men for long. It ended up being young boys and teenage boys.
Yeah.
Which is where we're primarily going to see him focus. In August of 1964, Dean was drafted into the U.S. Army, and he completed basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana. He reportedly did fine with an unblemished record, from what I could find. This is one of the first times I saw a boyfriend mentioned, so it did seem like he did pursue a relationship with someone else. It was someone else in the service, I believe, and he had engaged in a romantic relationship with him, and it seemed like this was the first relationship that he had with a man, perhaps the first time being away from his family and maybe other influences like at home that he maybe felt comfortable for the first time ever being in a relationship. I don't think he was out. I won't say that like he was flaunting it or anything like that, but I think that this is the first report of him actually finding comfort in somebody else.
Yeah.
And feeling comfortable maybe just that like his mom's not breathing down his neck because she was very against anything queer.
Yeah, and also if you're in like small town anywhere at this time, but especially down south, the idea that you'd be comfortable enough seeking out someone else is like unheard of, but also that other people would be comfortable enough to let you know that they are someone you could seek out is probably unlikely. And here where it's, you know,
you have a lot of men all together.
Yeah. Without a lot of outside forces like that.
Yeah. I mean, probably very specifically no outside forces because they're focused on this one thing. They're really segregated from the rest of,
right,
you know, their community. When you're in the military, you know, you're going through like your basic training, like you're not getting to just go hang out and do whatever you want. Like, it is very regimented.
Right.
But you are with the people that you are with for a long time. You go through a lot together.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's where some of this like relationship blossomed. But this was seemingly the first opportunity he had to live out this part of his life that he was scared for people back home to learn about.
Right.
Doesn't seem like this relationship lasted very long. And that could have been due in part to his discharge.
Mm-hmm.
In June of 1965, not even a year into his service in the Army, Dean's mother, Mary, argued financial hardship and said that she needed him to come home to help with the business.
Right.
She had now divorced and she was running the Coral Candy Company by herself and she needed his help. So she called him back home. And he actually was granted this release and was honorably discharged.
Yeah.
Which somebody like Dean Coral being given an honorable discharge is shocking to me. But I think his service was so brief, he really didn't do much. He wasn't able to do anything. And because here's this woman trying to run this, they're not very wealthy and she needs him. It was one of those like hardship situations where it was granted and approved. But it was also said that Dean really did not like being in the military. Well, so maybe this was in part her way of trying to get him out, even if the hardship wasn't so hard. I don't know how else to put it, but
yeah,
trying to help him in a way get out.
I have heard that as a theory. It's also like he was there for less than a year. So am I glad that he didn't wreak havoc there for sure? But do I think if he was there longer, we would have seen more issues?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't think he had enough time to like completely burn it to the ground.
That, and also, I mean, this is during the days of like the draft. So clearly he didn't sign up for this himself. It was a place he was put. And I think you can only be on best behavior in that scenario when you're someone like Dean Coral for so long.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he was discharged. And he returned to Texas. The candy company was now running out of the Houston area. And the Houston Heights area specifically, the northwestern part of the city, was experiencing similar difficulties to Vidor. While it was more built up, the community was full of poverty. Lots of broken homes and high crime. More and more people flooded into the city. But it didn't really have the resources yet to support that kind of volume. It didn't even have enough to support the people that were already there.
Right.
But the population just continued to increase through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Houston itself was coined the murder capital of the United States. The police force did not have the quantity nor the quality of staff to manage the growing population, and more importantly, the growing crime.
Right.
We're going to talk about Houston a lot and all of the crimes that Dean committed within this community, and there's plenty of law enforcement problems to talk about that we're going to get into in this series. But I also want to point out that there were a lot of confirmed murders going on, and a lot of what Dean did was a lot of like considered missing persons. And we're going to see a lot of really poor police work of dismissing these missing persons as runaways. And their focus was likely more on the confirmed bodies that they had in front of them.
Right.
There was so much there.
Yeah, they didn't even have enough to go through every single thing with the eye or the detail that they probably would have wanted to that was in front of them, much less that plus all of the suspected and unconfirmed.
Yeah, the investigative capacity that they had was limited at best.
Minuscule.
So let's talk a little bit about Houston and the police department as a whole and just kind of give a little bit of background here. I'm not saying this stands for what it is today, not at all, but it's important to recognize what was going on at this point because a lot of you are going to wonder how the hell Dean Coral got away with what he did for as long as he did.
Yeah.
Here's part of the reasons. In the 1940s, the Houston police gained the ability to perform fingerprinting.
Woo!
Revolutionary stuff at the time. And when they fingerprinted their own officers, they had to fire 15 of them on the spot due to them having previous criminal records they didn't know about.
Yep.
So you had actual people who, like, you know, you would have arrested.
Yeah.
Part of your workforce. So let's, like, consider what kinds of deals were made and what kind of criminality was happening within that department, because you had actual criminals working there.
Yeah.
Okay. To further hammer home this point, the 1950s and 60s were also revolutionary to the Houston police force because they adopted hiring qualifications that they didn't previously have, including requiring their officers to have a high school diploma and a passing grade on an entrance test. This means that prior to this, the police force may have in part been convicted offenders themselves, didn't graduate high school, or didn't even know enough to pass the most elementary of tests.
Yeah, and that's obviously problematic for a lot of reasons.
And at that time, you could say, I want to be a cop. They'd say, you look like you could probably do it. Would you like a badge and a gun? Here you go.
And here's some power.
That is where a lot of that came from. And so a lot of that was really, really important to mention before we talk about just how bad this can be.
Right.
There was a time before easily accessible records and the internet where the hiring process was really easy to fool.
Yep.
Without proper vetting protocols that we have today, many people could have become officers that displayed unethical behaviors, questionable morals, clear biases, and more.
I mean, you could literally be someone who is working in, I don't know, the courts. You're an attorney, and maybe you make a wrong traffic move, and someone who didn't even finish high school is coming around, and hell, you might have even convicted them before for something. But mm-hmm. they have the power to take your freedoms away. And obviously this has gotten better. We love that they're adopting standards, that they're upping these standards. But that means for so long, they didn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Today, the process looks much different around the country. We see many police departments with very strict vetting processes. Though with so many vacancies in police departments around the country, some have resorted to lowering the standards of the applicants they accept in order to keep up with the population in their communities. It's a vicious cycle. But to give you an idea of some of what the process looks like in a lot of places locally, it typically includes a lengthy entrance exam, a physical fitness test, a significant background check, a driving record check, calling your loved ones, partners, ex-partners, friends, employers, former employers, and coworkers. They'll ask them about your ethics, your sense of humor, your personality. Are you quick to anger? How do you handle stress? Your reputation, values, work ethic, morals, and more. They'll contact your previous employers and retrieve your employee record. Anything you've ever been written up for will be questioned. They can stop by your house at any time and see how you live, not just when you have time to prepare. Are there drugs? Is there a lot of alcohol? Is it a mess? It all matters. They pore over your financials. An applicant in significant debt might be disqualified because they're at a greater risk to accept a bribe. Mm. There's often a psychological evaluation that asks you everything under the sun, and a polygraph test that if deception is detected, your interview process could stop right there.
Right.
So when you consider the steps that most police departments take now to ensure that they hire moral, effective officers, there is a stark, blinding contrast to what existed many years ago. I don't mean to pick on Houston here as if it were unique. It wasn't. These problems existed in a lot of places for a lot of reasons. But when we look at Dean Corll and what he was able to do, part of his getting away with it for so long was poor police work and that the police weren't trained or vetted properly.
Right.
And the good ones weren't given the resources or tools to do a good job and wouldn't have had the backing of the department to do so. In fact, at this time, most of the officers there had to have part-time jobs because they were paid peanuts, and they were told specifically not to do too much, don't make more than a couple of arrests a day, because they literally couldn't afford it.
Right. The paperwork Like alone.
The paperwork alone, the holding, the housing, the all of it, they just weren't able to keep up. So it was like, it wasn't that you need to have so many stops or you need to do so much in a day. It was like, you better not go over this amount in a day. There were mountains of issues here, and it's important to acknowledge the implications these all surmounted to.
Right.
By the time Dean returned to Houston, the candy business was doing well.
Yeah.
In 1965, the company relocated to right across the street from Helms Elementary School in Houston. A predator setting up shop in plain sight under the guise of sugar and harmless fun. You see, he would invite the school children over to the candy shop after school, where they would be given free candy. These are children, mind you.
Yep.
This is how he earned the name the Candyman. A friendly, relatively handsome guy who kept to himself, would help you if you needed it, and unbeknown to them, was eyeing and tracking future victims.
Yeah.
For many of the children who visited the candy shop, it was the highlight of their day. Again, many of them came from broken homes, abusive families, or were ignored. Dean made them feel special, and he gave them something to look forward to. In fact, he offered them candy that they probably had never had before because their families could never have afforded it.
Right.
He wasn't the kind of guy that the kids were warned about. They loved him. He didn't come off as creepy or too eager. He just played it right. The school complained to Dean, though. Not about his giving free candy to the kids, or, you know, the fact that this was a grooming tactic. I don't think that they knew what he was up to, but their chief complaint with him was the fact that in order to get there from the school, the kids needed to cross a really busy street, and they felt it was dangerous because these kids were so young.
Right.
Dean didn't care, though. He still kept inviting them over, turning the candy shop into a safe space where the kids could let loose a little bit, eat candy they couldn't afford, and take a break from their lives.
Yeah.
Dean ended up living in an apartment above the candy store, and in the back of the store, he put a pool table and other things so the kids would spend more time there. Employees later said that there was a back room in the shop they named the Pouting Room, because it's where Dean would go when he got really angry. Dean had a temper he kept hidden. When the anger boiled up, he would disappear into the Pouting Room, and while no one knew exactly what he was doing back there, he did also come out seemingly fine. So he'd go back there really mad, be there for a bit, come out, he was fine, so like he must have pouted in there and gotten it out, I don't know.
Right.
Around this time, Dean also had a preoccupation with digging, which later is believed to be how he was disposing of bodies earlier on before other bodies that were ultimately found. But Dean dug out the floor of the Pouting Room and then covered it back up and filled it in with cement, so we can only imagine what was there. When he was asked about this random-ass digging he was doing at the candy shop and at a shed that he claimed that he had to bury the spoiled food and candy or it would attract bugs and bees, and it was the best way to dispose of it all.
Which, get real. Get so fucking for real. But also, imagine being at work and someone's like, oh yeah, no, the candy is just bad. So I dug a hole, filled it in so that bugs wouldn't get to it, despite the bugs that live in the ground. And then I filled it in with cement.
Suspicious. But Dean was just seemingly so harmless. It was like, I don't know why he does it, but we don't know how to run candy business. He does, so we must be doing something right.
Right. I've also heard that, like, he was a little bit paranoid, and maybe this was to keep people from using spoiled candy to create their own recipes or sell to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But
no matter what you thought he was doing or if it was weird, you definitely didn't think he was murdering kids and burying them.
I sure as shit hope not.
You didn't think that. That wasn't on anyone's bingo card. Even if it should have been, it wasn't. Now, his mom, Mary, she then married another man, a merchant marine. She got linked up with him through some dating service in Houston. And after a very brief courtship, she married him. Needless to say, marriage wasn't really her thing, and the relationship soured very quickly, if it was ever even sweet. This guy may have had some brains to him, though, because he questioned Mary as to why her adult son spent so much time with kids and that it was weird. But Mary defended her son. Her husband also said that he thought Dean was gay, which to Mary was like worse than calling him a pedophile that spent a lot of time with kids. And she staunchly said, no, Dean is not gay. He's a loyal and obedient boy, as if he couldn't also be loyal, obedient, and gay. As if.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a great read on Dean Corll, I recommend Jack Olson's book. It's a great source and is available on Google Books for less than $20. He interviewed many people from this area, including police officers, parents of victims, people who knew Dean, and also Mary herself. And a lot of the information that we get about Dean is from Mary's accounts of him, and a lot of Mary's accounts can be found in this book. So if you're interested, I highly recommend you read this.
She sounds like a slinky little minx.
She's something.
And I mean, listen, I don't know shit about shit, but she sounds like she's great at marriage. She's done it so many times.
I mean, yeah, she's great at the getting married part, I would say. So she's got the first part.
Yeah.
Down.
And like, wow.
Yeah. I mean, they say if you're good at something, you never work a day in your life. But Mary divorced that guy. Maybe it was because he accused her son of being gay. I don't know. But you guessed it. She found another one. She married Walt Colburn soon after meeting him. And if you thought it went well, no, it didn't. Another divorce. And at this point, Mary kind of threw her hands up in the air and probably figured that she just couldn't find love.
Yeah.
But she thought, well, maybe let's find out why.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what the reason for this is, but I have to imagine that it was something like she was seeking love advice. But she did go to see a psychic who advised her to get out of Houston and just leave.
Oh.
And with this advice, she did. She packed up and she moved to Colorado, leaving the candy business to Dean. Dean moved into an apartment not far from a different elementary school where he had a black light, a stereo, and a TV for parties.
Wow.
Dean had a perfect chameleon-like ability to blend in. He wasn't lurking in the bushes of a local playground or holding up in the stall of a restroom waiting for a victim. In fact, he wasn't going to them at all. They flocked to him. Sweet Dean with a soft spot for kids. He almost exclusively was spending time with children and teens, and after his mother moved away, he had little to no adult interaction, save for an on-again, off-again, mostly off-again girlfriend that he had, who was as oblivious as Mary.
Yeah.
At first, he plied the young ones with candy and soda and a fun place to play pool. And as his victim type aged, so did his approach. When you're a kid, the coolest thing to get is free candy, soda, and attention. But when you get older, that kind of gets a little bit lame, and the next coolest thing is having somewhere to go to break the rules and be a little bit bad, listen to music, and party. He ended up hosting parties where tweens and teens could come and smoke weed, do inhalants, drink alcohol that he supplied for them, listen to loud music, play pool, and hang out. It was a party spot that drew in even more kids, and many of the same ones who used to line up for free candy when they were younger. We've mentioned this in other episodes, but it bears repeating. Stranger danger isn't the only danger out there. There's an assumption that those who mean to harm you, especially to harm children, will be these unknown offenders, but it's more likely that if a child is to be abused, it will be by somebody they know. We also expect them to look ghoulish, a dead giveaway in the face or posture. But instead, Dean Corll was handsome, average, friendly, and mostly kept to himself.
Yeah.
Kids went to him. And if the parents said anything, it was to their kids to leave that kind man alone and let him work. To which Dean would say, they're no bother, they're just kids having fun. More accurately, we should be looking for strange behavior danger. Conversations where an adult asks a child to keep a secret, not tell mom or dad, or keep something special just between the two of them. That's how it started when Dean began grooming David Brooks. And that, my dear listener, is where we will leave you for part one.
Oh, it's just beginning. It's just beginning, you guys. Next week, we are going to cover a lot more about David Brooks, more about Dean and the early days that we know of in his killing, in his crimes that, again, are confirmed. And
we'll talk about many of the victims. We'll talk about the way in which he lured them.
Yes.
A way in which he could avoid suspicion, a way in which he tried to make it look as if they weren't killed. We're going to talk about all of that and more. This was your introduction to Dean Corll and sort of the background on him for what we know. And I wish I could tell you it gets better from here, but it doesn't.
Yeah, this is definitely the lightest of the episodes we'll have, but important information nonetheless, especially since you guys know where we're going to end up at the end of this. It gets pretty dark and pretty twisted pretty fucking fast. So we hope that you guys take a look around our Instagram. You can see the people, the places, the things we are talking about in this episode, in every case and episode. But also, you could get a little reprieve, a little meme highlight is up there, because this is gonna, oh, it's so bad, you guys. I just, my brain is melting out of my body. It is so horrifying to read and to listen to and to see, and so important with all of the kids and all of the people that this impacts. So if you need a silly little laugh, which you very well might, we have a great space for that. We have resources if you need someone to talk to, or just if you've listened to other cases on here and you're like, hey, I could use some help with those two. Allie does a great job of keeping all of those things pinned right up at the top.
You can always check out our highlights. That is, again, where you'll find those reprieves, those funny, good time, I don't know, make you smile, make you laugh, make you something. Resources, we have a lot of them. If you want to see what other episodes we have, you can also just kind of click through the episodes highlights. We have what victims' families have done in honor of their loved ones. We have safety tips. I mean, we have a lot. You can kill an hour or two on our Instagram page. And we think you should check there. And unfortunately, I have to say that this was the least disturbing episode that you're going to hear in this series.
Yeah.
So this was sort of your introduction, light version of this before we really jump in next week into really the meat of what Dean was doing and how he was able to do it.
Yeah. So in this week, take a look around, see what you can find. If you are interested in it, watch that interview. It's pretty great, and it will set you up definitely to like sort of enter this. We know it's a tough space, but a very important one to share.
In the meantime, we think, again, you should rate us 5 stars. We're biased, but hey, you asked, we told you. We think that you should also touch grass, kiss your pod pet, and tune back in next week.
Yeah. So if I do look at my clock, that was about time for true crime.
Bye. Bye. Gets worse from here, folks.
Christ. Ugh.